Hello, friends of the internet, and welcome back to Alili. Hello, guys. How are you this week? Hope you had a nice week and you're enjoying maybe your weekend if you're hearing this in the weekend, maybe your week if you're hearing this on the moment that it went out. But yes, hope you're enjoying whatever day you are on. So, today, guys, we're gonna talk about something really amazing. It is a movie that many people, I think, will love. And if you have seen it, you love it, I hope. It's from the famous director Wes Anderson, and it's one of his classics, and I think one of his biggest hits, I will say, when it went out. And it's the movie The Grand Hotel Budapest. This movie, guys, is so amazing. We're gonna talk about a little bit of the plot, some information about the movie or behind the scenes, hints of history in the movie and filming locations, and of course, we cannot forget the fun facts. Take your cup of coffee or tea or beverage of sorts. Go into your sofa, go for a walk, whatever you do when you're listening to the podcast, and let's start! The Grand Budapest Hotel is a 2014 comedy-drama film written and directed by Wes Anderson. Ralph Fiennes leads a 17-actor ensemble cast as Monsieur Gustave H., famed concierge of a 20th-century mountainside resort in the fictional Eastern European country of Subroka. When Gustav is framed for the murder of a wealthy dowager, Tilda Swinton, he and his recently befriended protege Ciro, Tony Revolori, embark on a quest for a fortune in a priceless Renaissance painting amidst the backdrop of an encroaching fascist regime. Anderson's American Empirical Pictures produced the film associated with Studio Balzberg, Fox Searchlight Pictures, and Indian Paintbrush. Well, guys, let's start with some information about the movies. The story of the movie was created by Wes Anderson himself, and he collaborated with Hugo Guinness. They went with the story of the movie and they created the characters and everything. But at some point, Hugo Guinness decided to just drop out of the project, but he still got credit for the story. They struggle a little bit with the brainstorming of the ideas for the story, but they did some cool experiences touring around Europe and searching for inspiration. Not only location inspiration, but also they inspired themselves on a lot of Austrian literature. So there was an Austrian novelist that was the first inspiration for Wes Anderson and Hugo Guinness for the story. That is Stefan Zweig. I don't know if I'm saying it right. Zweig. That shaped the vision of the film. One of the greatest things that we can say about Wes Anderson films is that they are a lot made by hand. So it's like an old school kind of cinema because he doesn't go into CGI as much, or he tries to avoid it at all cost. And so, for example, for this movie, the country of Subrovka is fictional, it doesn't exist. So they created their own original architecture, the money, the fashion, the government documents, and all of this was mostly built by hand. So that's the thing that makes him unique, because Wes Anderson really goes into the sensibility of a graphic illustrator, as they said, and he prefers to do things the analog way, the handmade way, and that's how he gives this beautiful organic feeling in his movies. And it kind of like looks like a picture, like a stop motion picture, because he uses a lot of stop motion to do many of the shots. Yeah, it feels so weird, like it's organic, but at the same time it's so cartoony and so like robotic. The characters are so in a weird way. They always have this spunk of things in their way of speaking, and their way of walking, the way of running. It always looks in a different feel. You know that it's a Wes Anderson film when you see this type of performance. So you can see that many of the decors were done old school. So it's all cardboard. For example, the the trains, there was no train, like no real life train created for the movie or used in the movie. They created it as of cardboard. Also the Grand Hotel Budapest and the pink facade is all created on a 9-foot tall model. The pastry boxes from the fictional Mendel's Bakery didn't magically fall open as they appear to. It rather has someone behind that has a little cable, like invisible fishing line cable, that will open up the box. That's how they did it, like really old school way, and it really pays off. So because these decors and all the props are made, like really made by hand, the actors can touch and everything, it gives more of a sensibility to it, because you can see the props and everything age and kind of lived in. And when the actors interact with these handmade places or this handmade decor or whatever, they interact with something visible and really that appears in their set. So it gets more of an organic feeling, an organic performance, because they can actually see it and touch it and feel it. So it gives another thing different than when you use CGI. Don't get me wrong, I love CGI. CGI gives you a lot of things, but for Wes Anderson films, I prefer his taste in this field, because he is perfect for this kind of filming and this kind of performance. So, the person that created all of these props and all of these designs and decors is the production designer Adam Stockhausen, that he worked also on Moonrise Kingdom, and afterwards he worked with Wes Anderson in numerous other films, but he is so great. This movie is like amazing. He says normally, well, in a normal situation, like a production designer will find a location and then they will set it there and there will be the shot. But because this is a fantastical film and they have to create this atmosphere, he says like you have to create everything because you're dealing with a fictional world. One example is like he constructed many of the shots with the train and the windows of the train, but it's not an actual train. It was not used, they didn't use a real train for the film. They just did it like theatrical way, so they created a cardboard set that will have a window, and then that's it. It's just that. So it really gives the feeling of where we are, but without using all of the real elements, we will say. One of the things that Stockhausen says that it was the more intricate work for this movie was the set change. For example, for the hotel, they didn't find a hotel that would be suited for filming. They had many inspirations, obviously. They wanted to use a real hotel that existed already, but obviously the hotel, the management will not stop working just because there is a production filming in the hotel. So like it will be full of guests and people that were not meant to be on the film. So they decided to just use an abandoned department store in Görlitz, Eastern Germany. It's called the Görlitzer Warenhaus. And that's the place where the set, the interior set for the Grand Hotel Budapest will be done. So in that place, they had to do set changes because the movie moves from different periods of time. And the big two are between the 60s and the 30s. So the 60s is when the hotel is on hands of Mr. Mustafa, and it has another lobby, it has another architecture, and it's more like modern, we will say, in warm tones and everything. But then we go into the 1930s lobby that is like well into this classic kind of architecture. And it's all pink with tones of red and purple, and everything has like a really sophisticated touch. So that was the big thing, because they had to create a big set inside this warenhaus. The thing is that they had to rebuild afterwards on the same interior set, another set. So it's a set within a set. Just so we're clear, the 60s hotel is built inside the lobby of the older 30s hotel. So not only the issue, or not the issue, but the complicated thing was to build a set within a set, but also because they had to take it apart over a weekend or stuff like that. So it was like periods of time that were really quick to change. So you had to, I don't know, maybe they tried to record or film just a piece of the 60s while they were shooting also pieces of the 30s. So they were saying like, oh, can you take apart the set for the 30s and put the 60s, or take apart the 60s and put again the 30s, and you know, it's a big mess. They didn't use only sets, they also used true locations. They were scouting, for example, a location in Europe where they find a local civic center that once was beautiful and now it's left to rot, and they were seeing how this place had a lot of potential to be the dining room of the hotel in the 60s. So they ended up using that space as the 1968 dinner conversation between Mr. Mustafa and the young author that is Jude Law, that provided narration on how the hotel changed, but it kind of gave also like traces of the 30s vibe of the hotel. One thing that Stockhausen says is that one of the fun things about working with Wes is that the stories relate to place. Everything in the Wes Anderson universe is going into the place that the story is happening. For example, they're doing an Eastern Europe film, they're not shooting it in California, they're shooting it in Eastern Europe. They shoot in Prague, in Germany, Eastern Germany, and all that. That kind of gives the narration of the films. The place also gives description of where we are, what time is it, which period is it, and how it looks on the storyline, if it is a good day or if it's a bad day as well. Just to go back quickly on the train things, as I said before, the train doesn't exist. They didn't film a real train for the movie. And so they were saying, what can we do to make these scenes work? So they decided just that we're gonna be seeing the inside out of the train. What you see is like only the inside. You never build from the outside, so no one sees the exterior of the train. So you never see the train. You are on a train, you feel you are on a train, but you don't see the train. You can see the same approach of the train, the illusion of the train, when Zero and Monsieur Gustave are doing a chase to Joplin, like the assassin Joplin. They're chasing him and they go into a ski chase and they're kind of like in a slide. But you never see the slide. Like, you see the slide at first when they put it, but then you never see it afterwards. You never see how the slide moves and in a more out frame. You don't never see it. And you feel that this chase is happening, that is movement, there's stuff happening, but you never see the actual slide. And on this slide chase, we can also see one of the big things that Wes Anderson uses on his work, that is miniature work, stop motion. So all the chase was done with stop motion. If you see Joplin like doing the movements of a ski person, he's doing that, but it's kind of like stop motion-y, you know, it's never fluid. You see that it's like a puppet. And that gives him another cartoony look that I was saying before for the characters. That they are so perfect and they are so immaculate and everything that they are kind of cartoonish, but they look so good and they look so well and they have their own issues and their own narrative. It's so great. That's what makes them great. This cardboard cartoon feeling. One of the other big things with the sets created on this movie is that they had a lot of inspiration from real places, even though it's a fictional place. For example, the lobby of the hotel had a lot of inspiration from old books and photos from continental classics like Berlin Athlon. So the Berlin Athlon was a hotel and they did the lobby layout inspired on that, which included like the coat check and the lobby bar and the barber shop. Stockhausen said, "We took our favorite pieces and combined them together. We did our own version of the beautiful fabric work and murals found in top hotels. All the fabrics are hand-done and the furniture is all antiques. we sourced locally from Eastern Germany and reached farther afield. We were pulling in from Vienna, Hamburg, Munich, Prague, even London, anywhere we could. But the big reference of them all for the hotel was on Carlo Vivari. If you have seen the Queen Latifah movie where she's almost dying and then goes a big, big hotel and she's like, oh, the Hotel Poop. Well, that Grand Hotel Poop from Carlo Vivari exists and obviously was the big inspiration from the Grand Hotel Budapest. The facade of the Grand Hotel Poop inspired a lot what a Grand Hotel Budapest is, and not only the outside but also the inside of it. So this is a great inspirational real place for this movie. They also were inspired by the Elovenska River in the city center that had these pastel painted buildings, all painted in shades of tangerine, pistachio, bright yellow, ochre, and that inspired the sets as well and how they will use these pastel colors for the movie. Now, for all the fans of this great movie, we have some locations that inspire the places in the movie, and there were some other locations that they film in it. So now you can visit them if you want to. So one of the first ones is Karlovy Vary on Czech Republic, the one that I told you just now about the Grand Hotel Poop that not only like inspire the facade of the hotel but also like the colors of the sets. The second location is Görlitz, Germany. As we said before, Görlitz, Germany is where the Warren House was found, so the Görlitzer Warren House, where they did the set inside this Warren House that was abandoned. They created the set of the 1930s hotel and 1960s hotel. So you can go in there and see the inside of it. One new thing that happened after the movie. When the movie did it, the Warren House was abandoned. But because tourists went a lot after the movie in Görlitz, they given the Warren House a motivation to reopen. So they reopened the department store once again. And fans from the movie will recognize the sweeping staircase from the chase scenes and can admire the iconic glass ceilings and chandeliers. So you can go inside, guys. It's no longer abandoned. It's now beautiful. The third location is, excuse my accent or the pronunciation, I'm not sure how to pronunciate it. The place is Bastei-Brook in Dresden. Bastei-Brook is in the south of Dresden, and if you see closely, is close to the border of Czech Republic in the natural park known as Saxon Switzerland. Snow caves, mountain serve as a backdrop for Ciro and Agatha's wedding. That's where they film that part of the film. Ooh. The fourth location is the Dresden Bakery, which is the shop that inspired Agatha's employer, so Mendel's Bakery, where they did the iconic courtesan au chocolat. Apparently, the interior was shot entirely in the real shop in Dresden, with minor alterations. They didn't just minor alterations, but it was all from the original place, so you can go and see it if you go to Germany. The original painted frescoes and embossed ceilings really exist in the dairy shop, regularly visited by villagers and tourists alike for milk, cheese, and strangely, cosmetics. The fifth location is Swinger Palace in Dresden. So, Zubrowska's art museum is played by the Swinger, a former Dresden palace that is now an art museum. The sixth and final location that was used on the movie is the Sphinx Observatory. The Sphinx Observatory is in Switzerland, which has surveyed the Alps since 1937 and can take in views of nearby mountains from the public viewing deck. So if you see it closely, this observatory is what gave the inspiration for the cable cars that go into the place where the monks are. Now guys, let's talk about the color palette analysis on this movie, because Wes Anderson is a crazy person for coloring. The colors on his movies are amazing, so let's talk a little bit about that. big thing to say is that the Grand Budapest Hotel takes place in four different timelines. Every timeline has their own aspect ratios and color palettes. The first and the main timeline is in 1932, which is timeline of Monsieur Gustave and the famous Grand Hotel Budapest in his pink form, in his prime, we will say. The hotel scenes have vibrant hues of red, purple, pink, white, orange, yellow, and brown that gives it a fantastical vibe of beauty and comfort despite the challenges that they have outside of it. So the Grand Hotel Budapest is kind of like a disguise to hide the cruelty of war that is happening during that time. So the colors give this sense of fantastical and beautiful and give the persons, like not only the viewers, but the people in the storyline, a sense that everything is alright. We have this safe place, Grand Hotel, but we can be safe here from the austerities and the war that is on the outside of the hotel. The second timeline portrays the timeline of the old Serum Mustafa, so the 1960s, when the writer comes to see the hotel and finds the story of Monsieur Gustave. This part of the film has different type of colors, like lush colors, in a very matte and darkish tones, which complements the story as the young author learns about the hotel. They show as well low saturated greens, and the interiors are in matte and mid-saturated oranges that give this kind of warmth and good sensation of comforting, like it's a different comfort from the first timeline that it was more like luxurious and everything's all right, everything's fantastical, everything is perfect. In this timeline is more like warmth, comfort, a rest place, and it gives an apathy to this timeline. So the apathy, the impassivity, the indifference of everything that is happening or that happened. How the hotel transformed from something beautiful, fantastical, incredible, to something without passion, without emotions, kind of bland. The change of the war, of the changes that made also the war, it's seen on this 1960s new hotel. The third timeline is really short, but it's still an emphasis on the colors, and it's in 1985 where the older author is talking to us about how he did his book, how the true story came for him to do this book. And we kind of see the colors that were on the second timeline that are kind of brown and orange palette to give this sense of apathy and just bland and comfort and warmth. And then the fourth timeline is really short as well, is when the film starts and it ends with a girl that is coming to the graveyard to see the author's tattoo. In this one we see a little bit more of other tones of color, more pinkish kind of undertones, but they are drained out, so they are not like as pastel as the first timeline on the 1930s. It's kind of cold and it's still drain out of color, so it's a normal cold ambience that is giving this. But I will say for me, these colors are kind of reviving the colors from the first timeline. They are a little bit there, not too on your face, but just giving you the hint that something fantastical is happening on this cold world. Wes Anderson also uses color not only to talk about the timelines, but the characters and the position in their story. So if you see closely, the antagonist, all the fascist police and everything, is dressed in dark colors, kind of gray. The ones that are more into the government are more like gray, and the others are more dark. And the protagonists are bright colors. And if you see closely at the beginning of the movie, you can see something really weird that I don't know if I saw it before when I saw the movie. I've seen it many times, but like this time that I rewatched it this week, I found something really weird. When the author is in the 1985 timeline. And he's with his grandson, I imagine. The grandson is dressed in gray and dark colors. And he kind of like imitates the fascist and police that is going to happen on the movie. Because he, when we start the movie, he kind of shoots his grandpa with like a fake gun. And then when we are starting to get into the movie, we see the author on the center looking at the camera. And then the grandchild is also looking at the camera, but with the gun pointing at us. Maybe when you see that, I will say like, there's something happening. There's something bad that will happen in this story, even though we don't see it as much. We still get the hint of the bad thing that is going to happen on that war. A thing that Stockhausen said when they started with the all pink timeline is, we started with an all this pink, and I think this would be true of any color. If you use too much of it, you stop seeing it because it's everywhere and you start taking it for granted. So we found that we have to add in yellows and different colors to kind of cut it back so you could see it more. That meant that at the beginning, when they were trying to film and everything, they did all the sets completely in this pastel pink and everything was pink. But because too much pink is too much, then you don't see actually the color. You will not see the emphasis that the color is doing on the movie. So they decided to just add specks of other colors. Now we're gonna talk about a little bit of the hints of history that the movie has. So as you know, the film is done in the 1930s in the Eastern Europe. We are on the moment and place the World War II started. The movie, it doesn't actually take place in Budapest, but in a near town called Lodz, in a fictional Eastern Europe country on Zborowska. Wes Anderson said that Lodz is Vienna, Prague and Budapest all roll into one. And then the film's political backdrop is an amalgamation of the two world wars. So if you see, we have hints of the First and the Second World War in the movie. You can see that during the movie, we have this geopolitical event in motion that appears to be a monarchy crisis that happened on the First World War. But then we start to see this fascist force being on power in different parts of the movie. So I will say like the first part of the movie will be more of World War I, and then the second part is more of World War II. You can see this clearly times that he goes into the train, because the first time he goes in the train, he kind of like encounters this weird militia that is stopping them, and it's kind of like grayish coming into this First World War, I will say German soldiers, kind of. And then the second time they come around this train, they enter with a different type of police that are having the seed signature emblem that recalls the SS. We see how the police change more into a fascist police, and then there is when Zero says that he was killed on that event, because, well, you see how changed the timeline and how the history is more present. In the movie, they are never called Nazis, but they have this clear emblem of seed that really recalls the SS, and that's how you symbol that this is a direct reference to that. So what these hints of history do on the actual story timeline, so the storytelling, is not only a movie about inheritance battle or jailscape or love story, whatever you want, but it's more like a personal revelation for Monsieur Gustave that the world that he knows is changing. The world that he loved and made him is coming to an end. His hotel, as is shown in the narrative, lives across decades. So it falls from the peak of his prime to falls into despair and falls into these hands of this horrible fascist government, and then goes back into something bland that we will see later, that is more like after the conflict came the communism. So the communist subjugation and the modernity of it makes it bland. So that's the kind of 1960s timeline that we see how this hotel went into the decades and changed in each one of them to make the change on what happened in the history of the world. Now, my people, let's talk about something fun, like fun facts. First fun fact. Harvey Keitel slapped Tony Revolori in the face 42 times. So in the scene in the Grand Hotel Budapest when Monsieur Gustave is escaping the jail with his inmates' friends, there's one of them that is called Ludwig. Ludwig is the one played by Harvey Keitel. And when they are like going to the end and they meet Zero, when they go out of the tunnel, he says to Zero, "Good luck, kid," and slaps him on the face. But that slap was a true slap. So he really slapped the actor on that scene, and he was more than okay by him being slapped. But Wes Anderson took 42 takes to get this scene on a place that he would like. So the actor Keitel slapped Revolori in the face that many times. Second fun fact. On-screen newspaper headlines secretly spoil the movie. Throughout the movie, we see the characters having to read the newspaper to know what is happening and how the events are happening. But in most movies, the newspaper, the headline is shown, the content of the articles will have nothing to do with the plot of the film. But Wes Anderson personally wrote every newspaper headline feature in the Grand Hotel Budapest. So there is a newspaper article that can be spotted on screen that is in the beginning of the movie, and that secretly it spoils the whole plot on the movie, including the end. Amazing! I never spotted this. Third fun fact. Did you know that I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right, but Saoirse Ronan had a hard time making the courtesan au chocolat. Why? So normally, in normal movies, you will have a real baker do the baking and everything and put the stuff on the set, and then the actor will come and finish a little bit or just pretend that it made it. But this was not the case in the Grand Hotel Budapest, because Wes Anderson decided that it would be more organic and more real if the Saoirse Ronan, Agatha, the character, did it herself. So he pushed Ronan, he didn't push, but asked her to really make pastries herself. And of course, Ronan didn't find the pastry making easier to master. Four fun fact. It took 5 hours to apply Tilda Swinton's old lady makeup. So Tilda Swinton played the 84-year-old socialite named as Madame D. So we see her at the beginning of the film when she's introduced with Monsieur Gustave. Obviously, the actress is not an old person, so she had to endure 5 hours of makeup to get this aging makeup on her face. One other good thing to know is that Wes Anderson doesn't spend a lot of money, a lot of budget on his movies. He never does any extravagant services, but on this movie, for this character, he decided to get the best makeup artist to do this work. So that's when he really put a little bit more money into it, so that he can get a cool and beautiful prosthetic and that it looked convincing. It is really convincing at the end. Fifth fun fact. The Grand Budapest Hotel was shot in 3 different aspect ratios. Yes, I did mention it a little bit before, but hear me out. Wes Anderson decided to shoot the movie in 3 different aspect ratios. So first is 1.371, then the other one is 1.851, and then the second one is 2.351. And this will help the audience to know which period we are in, because the movie is on three historically periods, so the 80s, the 60s, and the 30s, and the aspect ratio will change in each one of them so that we know where we are. But imagine the difficulty for the movie theaters. So the producers gave strict instructions to theater projectionists on how to project the movie. So they instructed them to project it on 1.851, so it's the standard setting, and they were also given like specific technicality notes for the match brightness and the audio configuration. This movie is a masterpiece. 6 fun fact. Zero was the toughest role to cast. So the casting director Douglas Abel managed to get a ton of the famous faces for the Grand Budapest Hotel, but the role proved to be toughest was Zero, because they didn't know what to do with Zero. They really wanted someone that was a teenage boy, unknown, and preferably with Arabic origin or with Arabic characteristics. Eventually, they got someone that is Tony Revolori, that is more of Guatemalan origin, but he has what they wanted them. 7 and final fun fact. Well, if you don't already know, the painting on the movie isn't a real one. So the Renaissance painting called Boy with Apple, that is the key role that is happening in the action of the film, is not an actual painting of the Renaissance era. It's just a concocted thing for the film. Painter named Michael Taylor did the picture for the movie, and it took 4 months to create. Well, friends, that is all for today's episode. Hope you like it. Sorry if this episode was a little bit more longer, because this movie has so many stuff to talk about. So I wanted to talk about all of this with you, and I hope you like it. I hope you enjoy it. I hope that now it gives you another perspective for this movie, or it gives you the idea of that, yes, I need to watch this movie, The Grand Budapest Hotel by Wes Anderson. Masterpiece. Love it. And I think this was my first Wes Anderson movie when I saw it. And when I saw it, I was like, this guy, I like it. I love it. And since that, I saw every movie that he made and that he has made until this day. Love it. If you want to watch it, you can find it on Disney Plus. And in Disney Plus, they have, I think, almost all the movies from Wes Anderson. So if you want to see other of his work, I will suggest you have a look into it. Remember to follow us on Instagram on Aleli Movie Podcast. We are sharing every single day a new reel with new fun facts about movies and cool stuff that you didn't know. I am also doing recommendations for movies for each week. So if you want to know what are my recommendations for the week, go down into your webpage on the podcast and click the link, and it will go into my Instagram account, or you can just search me in your Instagram, or you can follow the link on the description on the episode that I'm gonna put there. Thank you so much for supporting the podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and hope you had a nice day. Bye, friends.